radio station yourself down there. I guess you do internet broadcasting. But
yeah, it's on crusaderadio.com.
And that happens every, what, between 8 and 9 every day?
No, between 9 and 10, Monday through Thursday.
9 and 10, Monday through Thursday. And you were actually, you went to the courthouse to discuss this case, not in the courtroom, not disrupting or violating the court processes, but near, in the corridor outside. And you yourself were given a court order that you couldn't be anywhere near the courthouse after that. You were essentially barred from the area. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Judge Gregory Prickett in courtroom 12 sent an order out that said Wiley Drake could not be within 100 yards of his courtroom, and 100 yards of his courtroom put you outside in the parking lot anywhere in that courthouse, and that even if I were subpoenaed into that courtroom and had to be there legally, I could not use my cell phone or a public telephone. And that court order was issued and is still in effect. We went to the federal court in Los Angeles. The federal judges are golf buddies with him. And they got together and said, no, judges are judicially immune against prosecution. And so they threw our case out, even in federal court.
Wow. Well, you know, it sounds like the U.S. Taliban may be in power here, and we just never knew it.
Well, they really have been and continue to be, and we just have to continue to fight. I was in the courthouse yesterday, and I'm sure, you know, I many times in that courthouse, I was within 100 yards of Judge Prickett's courtroom. I'm not going to his courtroom. I'm not going to thumb my nose at him, but I will not stay out of that courthouse. And if he wants to arrest me, he'll just have to arrest me, because I have duties to my clients from a spiritual counseling point of view, and if they have to go to court, I'm going to court with them, and I'll do my best to abide by his order, but if I do violate that order, that's his problem. He can just put me in jail, and we'll just have to start another jail ministry or something, I guess.
Hey, you'd be just the man to do it, Wiley. We're talking with Wiley Drake, pastor of First Baptist Church in Buena Park. Am I right on that one?
That's correct. It's First Southern Baptist, and if you don't mind me putting in a plug,
go for it.
We do broadcast Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. at World Wide Web, crusaderadio.com, and anyone can call in just like I'm calling you, and the number there, if they want to call in on the show, is area code 559. For your folks, it'd be local.
Mm-hmm.
The number to call in is 559-732-5005, because our station is actually in Visalia.
Huh.
And so it'd be a close number for you, but they can call in on that number anytime between 9 and 10. And talk to us about what's going on in our area or their area as well.
And they can also tune it in on the internet at www..
You mean on Crusade Radio?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Crusaderadio.com.
Crusaderadio.com. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, is there anything more you want to add, Wiley, before we roll along?
Well, just simply to say thank you for allowing me time on your program, and keep up the good work that you guys are doing up there, and we'll just keep on fighting the good fight for the persecuted in our nation,
and
those of the unwashed, downtrodden, persecuted, and Christians as well, because they came through last night checking cars at our church, and they always do it coincidentally at our service times during the worship service.
Interesting. Wiley, appreciate your calling in, and I'm going to try to give you at least kick in some money for your phone call.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Every little bit helps, and we appreciate it.
Keep up
the good work you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Wiley.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Pastor Wiley Drake from Buena Park, California. That's a suburb of Los Angeles. Got this story on the internet, and hey, it seemed something we needed to talk about. He's a defender of homeless civil rights. We're getting back to the phones now. We're rushing ahead. Hi, we're on Free Radio Santa Cruz again.
Is this Robert Norris?
Yes, sir.
This is Mike Schmidt calling in. How's it going? Good show tonight.
Hey, you're listening, Mike? All right. Mike Schmidt, you are, of course, one of those notorious former Chamber of Commerce CEO-type fellows who then started mouthing off about the sleeping ban and how that seemed to be a human rights violation, and why can't the city and the county let people sleep, let's say, in, I don't know, the county parking lot, the Emmeline Street parking lot at night, when sort of a gone by dawn deal. And Marty Wormhout, the supervisor, was not happy.
No, she didn't see that as a good alternative. Of course, she likes to say, as she said a number of times, that she doesn't want to do anything that would condone this kind of behavior because she thinks it's intolerable that people have to sleep in their vehicles or sleep in the bushes or sleep on the streets. We just can't condone this. But then on the other breath, she doesn't seem to do a whole heck of a lot to try to, one, create safe and legal places for people to sleep, since we know that there's not enough shelter, even for the people who have lived here and been born and raised here. So it puts, unfortunately, homeless people in a between a rock and a hard place, especially if they're working poor people or they're working poor people who have families. And this was the area that I had originally gotten involved with, thinking if I could take a bite out of this issue incrementally and prove to those who are terrible and, I mean, are so naysaying about this issue in the first place, that it could be done. It could be done in a humane and conscientious manner, and that homeless people not only have rights, but they have dignity and they have the ability to be self-managed in many cases. So consequently, we never got that opportunity. But that's one of the reasons why I'm running for this office, is to see if we can hold a mega conference to try to sit down with homeless people and supporters and activists and service providers and the faith-based community and the politicos and all the rest, to see what it is and what can be done here and what we're willing to do, and to try to move this issue off the dime.
And you are, in fact, running for the 3rd District Supervisorial seat, which I guess there's an initial election March 5th, followed by another election in November, if nobody gets a majority.
You got it.
Your current opponents are Mark Premack, a city council person, and Marty Forever Supervisor Wormhout, who's been warming a chair there since, what is it, 1992 or something like that?
94, she was first
94.
Elected. Yeah.
Gotcha. I was listening to a tape of your speaking at Santa Cruz City Council back in 1999, when you took a position which was somewhat directly opposed to the one which you took a year later, in which you were kind of strongly hostile to any changes in the camping ordinance. I guess at that time we were really looking at cosmetic changes, like reducing the fine to $54, like letting a vehicle park in a driveway for three nights per month, like reducing it from a misdemeanor to an infraction. You seem to take a very hardline position, and yet you changed within the next year. Can you address that, why your position changed?
Well, initially, you know, I was when you're the CEO of the Santa Cruz Area Chamber of Commerce, you have a committee that all your structures go through. And I was just kind of buying into the party line because, in essence, I didn't know any better. I hadn't educated myself on the issue. As I had mentioned, I've probably mentioned numbers of times, I happened by chance, one late last December, a couple of years ago, witnessed some poor homeless guy getting beat up by skinheads as I was returning to my office, crossing the San Lorenzo bridge there for pedestrians, and I hollered out at him, and it just kind of was, you know, I went home and I told my wife, I says, you know, we just can't sit back and not do something. This is an issue the business community certainly has the ability to do something. And so I went back and lobbied my board. There wasn't unanimous at all. There was a lot of skepticism, and I said, and they put a lot of conditions on my involvement on the issue, and said, well, if I can get the downtown associations and the East Side, the Business Association, the Harvey West, the Natural Bridges, and maybe even the Mission Street Association to support establishing, at least as a first step, a safe and legal places for the vehicle housed, would you give me that green light? And they thought that would never happen. I think they honestly believed that none of these organizations would go along with it. Well, I had a few that I'd already seeded a little, you know, grass with, and got initial acceptance from the Mission Street Association. Emily Riley was very supportive of that situation.
At that time.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she hasn't followed through.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met with the Downtown Association and Colleen, who owns the coffee house there on Pacific Avenue. She was very supportive and rallied the troops, and we won in a majority vote to get the Downtown Association to support the concept. Met with the Harvey West Business Association. They thought that had merit too, and they supported it.
You spent hours and hours and hours convincing people who were hostile to the idea, right?
Yeah, and I think you know, the interesting thing is, in to me, was the mere shock that they had somebody like me who was actually speaking on this issue. And, of course, you had to first convince them it was a business issue. And fortunately for us, we had had the 2000 Census Homeless Needs Assessment project that showed that we had, you know, 20-30% of these people, almost 30% that were working poor people. And then when you'd go to these meetings, you would find, well, you'd have a business owner say, well, you know, I had a guy that was staying in my parking lot and actually helped reduce the crime because, and they were very nice people. And then another person would pop up and say, well, you know, two of my employees I know were homeless and for a while. And people began to realize that this wasn't somebody else's issue, that this was an issue that faced faced the business community here from their own employees and their own staff. And when you think about it, 89% of the businesses in this town, in this community, have nine or fewer employees. So we're really a small business community. And I think that helped me a lot. And I think, you know, having the credibility of being a CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, be willing to get out and try to rally the troops and to come up with something that was a program, which is what all of them wanted. They wanted something that was controlled, not willy-nilly, not just open the door. And I said, well, let's crack the door a little bit and let's put in a process. Let's ensure that police aren't going to be harassing people if businesses support this concept and so forth. And we were moving very, very nicely towards that until I think members of the city council who weren't in favor of this decided that this was something they had to sabotage, as they sabotaged nearly every other effort in this process. And the next thing we know, you know, one of the council members is on KGO radio telling them, well, the Santa Cruz City Council is going to repeal the sleeping ban. Come on down. We got plenty of room.
Mike Rutkin.
And so consequently, these people were just inundated, the two, especially the industrial parks. And, you know, the chicken got out of the bag and the cart was before the horse. And, you know, the neighbors and the businesses got terrified. Because we had promised them that we would have a process we would go through, there would be dialogue, we would work this out together, and with Mr. Rockin and others' help, it kind of took off on its own. And so, you know, fear and misperceptions became the rule of the day, and everything died on the vine.
You're talking about, of course, the May-June 2000 Safe Sleeping Zones proposal in the industrial areas,
yeah,
proposed by Fitzmaurice, Crone, Sugar, and initially Catherine Byers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You were invited sort of into the inner circle of then-Mayor Sugar's sort of joint committee, which excluded me and Becky and a few other folks, Becky Johnson.
Yeah, you know, your wild reputation caught up with you.
Well, you know, I am pretty wild and crazy. Now, however, you and I have been kind of going back and forth on the email. I sent you a long redraft of a proposed homeless plank, at least on the sleeping ban repeal. It no doubt doubles the length of what you had in mind. What did you think of what I sent you? I was suggesting that you make clear your feelings in a way that, you know, anybody who's accessing your website can read, and I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, to be perfectly frank with you, I have not accessed my email all day.
Mm-hmm. You're going to get it there, Schmidt.
You know, I worked last night, and then we started very early this morning. We got to 9,971 doors I've knocked on as of this afternoon at 5 o'clock.
Your knuckles are bleeding.
I am tired, now I'm filling out postcards here for voters and talking with you on the radio. So I'll be checking that later this evening, and then I'll let you know.
Coming up for you, Mike, in terms of, you think, the things that might be of voter interest that people might want to attend or know about in the next week?
Actually, I don't know of anything that's happening in the next week. You know, we had a community connection forum yesterday at their offices there in Harvey West Area Park. And we've had a radio show earlier this week. As far as I know, that's the last of the forums that I'm aware of anyway.
How are you doing? Any endorsements, or is Marty walking away with all the trophies?
Well, you know, when you've been in politics for 20 years, and you know, when you see the kind of things that have been done for some of these groups, that, you know, they'd be hard pressed not to. And some of them have told me quite confidentially, and have also told Mark confidentially that, you know, we're going to give her the endorsement. That doesn't mean we're going to vote for her, because we know the fear and intimidation and the wrath that could occur. And in some cases, we know that Marty and her people have you know, advised people, you know, even if she loses, she's got another till the end of 2002 to be in office, and there's going to be contract negotiations coming up, there'll be budget issues coming up, and, you know, you want to have a supervisor who's not there driving you crazy. And so it's easier, I think, to capitulate than it is to stand up and be counted. And unfortunately, I think the hallmark of liberals in this town is that it's easier to roll over and play dead and sign on, even if you don't agree, than it is to stand up and be counted.
So she'll be a lame duck even if you win outright in this March election, or if Premack wins?
Yeah.
So she'll have another 9 months to serve?
Yeah, it'll happen until the end of it, because we don't take office in January 2003.
Wow, it sounds like the kind of stuff they used to have back in the Congress in the 1820s or something, when they had lame duck Congresses. You know, you had to wait a year before getting a new Congress.
We moved the primaries up to try to give ourselves a bigger voice in the presidential races, and unfortunately that seems to move the primaries up for the off-year races as well. So we're, instead of a June primary, which we would normally have, and then a November, which could be a runoff, and then a November election if you needed to do a runoff, mm-hmm. we're now into March, and if we don't get 50% plus one, any of the three candidates, then the top two will be running in the until November. So
we're talking with candidate Michael Schmidt for the 3rd Supervisorial District, more important, an advocate and steadfast worker to redress human rights violations against homeless people in Santa Cruz. Michael, you have also been hearing the controversy around the privatization of the sidewalk, and you may take a different view of this than I do. What's your feeling about this new shiny green fence that's gone up on Pacific Avenue?
Well, I haven't seen the fence, so I was even downtown today, but I didn't notice it.
It now essentially takes away all the area that was used by the public to sit on the planter between the two kiosks, Sushi Now and Alibaba's Cafe, and makes that the private preserve and restaurant of these two kiosks.
Well, I certainly hope the city is getting, you know, some return on their investment since because obviously these folks are able to expand their square footage, and I'm assuming that, you know, since the going rate downtown is anywhere from $1.75 to $2.25 a square foot, that the city is reaping some additional rental.
Not as far as I know.
I kind of doubt it, but that's, you know.
It may be that they don't have more space in terms of their tabling area, but what they do have is they now have the area in front of their kiosks of people, you know, you can't sit within 10 feet of their kiosks. You can't sit within 10 feet of the railing. If you lean against the railing, as Ali warned me today, you'd be up for, you know, charges. If you sit on the planter inside their area without sitting at their seat or being a customer or a friend, you're up for trespass charges. It's a rather severe response to, you know, what have been some behavioral problems with a few people downtown. And I, you know, he asked me tonight, and I'm going to be playing that segment, what I suggested, you know, but anyway, go ahead. What do you think?
Robert, I got to catch another call. Be right back.
All right. Keep talking. Sure. Well, we're talking with Michael Schmidt, who sounds like he's a busy man. If you want more information on Schmidt, you can, is it Schmidt 2002? We'll ask him when he gets back on the line on the website.
Okay, I'm back.
All right. So, Mike, any thoughts on that? Well, then we'll let you go. What's the story? Well, I've been encouraging people to boycott Sushi Now and Alibaba's Cafe and New Leaf Market, not because I dislike the food at these places or even dislike their managements or businesses. As individuals, they're fine people, you know. It's their policies on this issue that I think are so bad. Now, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I'm caught between a rock and a hard place on this one. On one side, I feel that people who should have the free right of assembly, and as a member of Vision Santa Cruz and as someone who fought with due diligence to ensure that we had this kind of rolling plaza, which is why we had the larger sidewalks on one side of the street, the sunny side of the street versus the other side, this seems to be kind of going in the wrong direction. On the other hand, I also know that there's been an enormous amount of behavioral issues in that area. And if you're trying to run a business and your area is getting a reputation of either being in high crime or high nuisance or whatever, that can have an enormous dilatory effect on your business. And so I kind of see it from that perspective too. I think what we ought to be having here, instead of, you know, arbitrarily fencing off property that makes it restricted to the public, is to sit down in a cohesive manner with all parties to try to determine what can we do. Where are we going to allow, like, a free speech corner? I mean, used to have that in Berkeley. I don't know if they still have it. Maybe that's something we need to be looking at here. But then again, also, we need to make sure that people who come downtown are behaving in a manner that is respectful of other people's rights and dignities as well. And if some of the stories I've heard, especially in my walking and knocking, have any validity at all, and you wonder why people would look you eyeball to eyeball and tell you a bald-faced lie, I can't condone that either. So I don't know if I got, I don't know if that's the answer you want to hear. But
no, I want to hear whatever answer you think is true.
But that's kind of where I'm coming from. I'd like to see us, we need to be encouraging dialogue. You know, we're supposed to be so progressive, but we're actually pretty regressive here. And
yeah, the city council comes in with its prefabricated plan, rams it through, and that's it.
Well, whether we got the River Street sign the same way.
Yeah, we got
it. Now we're getting the Peace Park the same
way. And the safe sleeping zones that did not get any meaningful discussion.
Well, you know, it's just...
And the sleeping ban repeal that was defeated 2 years before that. I mean, it's and the Homeless Issues Task Force being ignored. One thing after another.
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's just... It's what Progressive Magazine called hyper-liberals. And these are folks who buy into the party line, but once they have theirs, that's the end of it. When it begins to infringe upon something that they have or they perceive they have, then their liberalism tends to go out the window, and their progressivism is lost in the shuffle.
We saw that with Camp Paradise, where the environmentalists, or enviro-fascists, as some have called them, were having, dare I say it, shit fits around the issue of Camp Paradise on the riverbank, but they didn't want to propose or allow for any kind of even light camping in any of the Greenbelt areas, even if that were done in concert with a nonprofit, in concert with a program where there was protection and where there was a respect for the environment and even kind of assistance to the environment. And that issue is coming back at City Council on Tuesday, a much weakened version of it that is so weakened, in fact, that I think...
Well, I understand that Mr. Premack, at least he's been saying in the debates that he is not going to support the second reading of this deal, and he believes that Mr. Kennedy will go along with him, and there's already, we know, 4 votes that are not terribly supportive of this concept in the first place, so I think this is going to die a very quick death, and it's more of just raise the flag to see if anybody will salute, and if they get 2 calls to tell them no, then they capitulate to their friends and don't try to provide any kind of leadership on the issue, which is one of the reasons why I got into this race, because I think, I'd rather stand up and have people say, I disagree with you, either intellectually or whatever, than to just turn around and say, I got 3 phone calls today from people who told me that they didn't like the idea, so, hey, I'm against it. This isn't leadership. This is just, followship, and this is what we've had in this town for far too long.
And, of course, Marty Wormhout has been a powerful voice against human homeless civil rights for many years on this issue, particularly around the sleeping ban. And that's one of the reasons that I, anathema as politics is to me in terms of these supervisors' races, I am pleased that somebody is at least raising these issues as you are. We're talking to Mike Schmidt. Mike, thank you for being on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Okay. You keep up the good work, and don't let them work you too hard.
How can people reach you at your website?
It's www.voteschmidt.com or via email, ilikemike2002@aol.com. Or you can always reach me on my cell at 252-1410.
And that is something that's amazing. You are almost always accessible.
I try to be. That's part of where I'm coming from.
I hope that's where you're going, too.
Me, too.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, phone lines again are open at Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrobs Piers Broadsides, and those 2 hours are going real fast. We've got about a half an hour left, so if you want to be on the air, give us a call at 427-3772. My apologies to the caller who was critical of my position on yuppie planter, as I call it now, the idea that there should be continuing protest and boycott of the businesses downtown that are primarily responsible for this privatization effort without any real public process. And I know we had one caller where there was another fellow who wanted to speak on the issue, hasn't been able to speak. Phone lines are open now if you want to call in, or if any of the Sushi Now workers, or at least the one worker and the manager want to call in, they're welcome to call in. And, of course, the same is true with Alibaba's Cafe. And the phone line is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. There is going to be a anarchist coffee house coming up on Saturday night with my old friend and favorite singer, Mark Levy. Mark is... a wonderful political folk singer. He's done some local Santa Cruz satire, and we need more of that. I'm hoping we can get some Jeff the Fiddler and others to start fiddling around with some lyrics, and maybe get some other people doing some Santa Cruz lyrics about that green fence we got downtown at Yuppie Planter. We need to start hearing and laughing about that more, and laughing about some of this stuff. Maybe if our laughter gets big enough and broad enough and bellyish enough, we can laugh these clowns down the street, because this is, in a way, it's very funny. In another way, it's not, of course. Again, this is the Anarchist Coffee House Open Mic House Party with Mark Levy, Strung Over, and that's a group, and it's going to be Saturday, February 23rd, 8 p.m., to benefit Free School Santa Cruz. It's at 1994 Ocean Street Extension, Santa Cruz. And you take Ocean Street north until it hits Highway 17, turn left immediately before the freeway starts, and follow our signs. Drug and free alcohol, or alcohol free, sorry about that. And volunteers are needed. You give a call to 515-4480, extension 3896. 515-4480, extension 3896. It's freeschools@onebox.com. Do I have that right? No, it's freeschoolsc@onebox.com. It's all one word, freeschoolsc@onebox.com. Also coming up on Saturday is a march and rally for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Leonard Peltier, and all political prisoners. Assemble and rally 11:30 a.m. Saturday, February 23rd at the Town Clock in downtown Santa Cruz. And the speakers are going to include Mel Mason, Monterey County Mumia Defense Coalition, Danny Garcia, October 22nd Coalition, Carlos Padilla and Adia Hines, Students for Justice over in San Jose, Matthew Willis, Uhuru Movement, Russ Redner, American Indian Movement, James Costner and Evelyn Schoenfeld, Santa Cruz Coalition and Free Mumia, Abu Jamal and all political prisoners, and of course, most important, Robert Norris and Becky Johnson, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and possibly Zoe Einbinder, if we can tie that woman down. She's a woman who was hauled away by the police. Sergeant Baker down there at Yuppie Planter. That's from the days when you could actually put a table there. Now they got their own tables, but the public don't get to put up no stinking tables. Thank you very much, Santa Cruz City Council, Downtown Association, Alibaba's Cafe, Sushi Now, and I've got to say, a brief tip of the hat to New Leaf Market for keeping silent on this issue for so long. Phone number to call is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. I've got a couple things I can do some reading from and will shortly. I'm kind of still looking at that phone line to see if anybody wants to jump in here while there is time. We actually have a bit of an update on how to access the HUF website. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We have a web maestro fiddling around with the website, setting it up. And he's actually gotten together a little taped message, but now since he's in the studio, we're going to allow him to even speak on that issue himself if he wishes. That's the notorious fiddler arounder, Jeff. Hey there, Jeff.
Hey.
Ho ho.
First, Robert, I just want to have a word for that caller who was on Alibaba's side. Mm-hmm.
I think it's Matisse's side, but maybe that's the same side.
Okay, well, it's all the same. It's the bourgeoisie, or the hippoisie, as it were.
The yup was he, perhaps?
Yes.
Who knows?
The caller said, cut your hair and cut your beard and get a job. And I'd like to point out, this is Mr. Norris's job. And secondly, I think it'd do that caller some good to grow his hair long and grow a beard and get a Volkswagen van and put a peace sign on the back of it.
Oh, this is this kind of talk is, what can I say? Well, what about that website stuff you're going to run down to us, Huff website guy?
Ah, yes. There's nothing the government fears more than communications by the people, and the Internet has been very instrumental. But before I tell you how to get to the secret HUF website, I have to warn you that the National Security Council has a computer program that sniffs out everything you send by email, and if you use any of those no-no words like T-E-R-R-O-R-I-S-T, or N-O-R-S-E, or any of those other hot buttons.
If you say you're going to kill the president, they're going to come and get you, folks. So don't tell them you're going to kill the president. And frankly, it might not be the best idea. Assassination is not the best thing to do at this time. That's just my personal opinion.
Right. So I recommend, if you really want to be safe, in all your emails, in the subject line, put, I love Sushi Now.
I love George Bush is another possibility.
Or I love Alibaba.
Well, I don't want to get too carried away here. But in any case, you were going to give us some advice as to what can people do who want to get to this HUF website. Where is it?
Yes, if you'd like to receive the inside story on HUF, What you need to do is just send an email, a blank email, or for that matter, a non-blank email. Just send any old email to the following email address, joinhuff@yahoo.com. Joinhuff is all one word. I mean, really, it's two words, but you just type it as all one word, and then you will receive an automated reply back telling you how to get to the secret website.
Wow. Now, that sounds pretty simple. You can't get to the secret radio station because we won't tell you where it is. But you can get to the secret website. Again, joinhuff@yahoo.com. It's pretty easy. Even I seem to be able to remember that. You might give it a try and see if you want to jump on board and see what these huffsters are up to. You know, it's.
And remember, include a tagline there for John Ashcroft, who might be reading.
Not forget John. Well, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathroom Spears Broadsides, the final minutes, the final 28 minutes, and we got some time here, so I'm going to roll into my next item unless I hear some phone action from you guys out there, and you women, 427-3772. I was sniffing around on the web the other day, and I got some very discouraging news, and I thought I had to pass it on. Some folks may be aware of the infamous AB 1421. That's a bill last year, a state bill, that is designed to gut protections for those accused of being committable. That is to say, those that police officers, psychiatrists, family members think should be locked up, shot up with drugs, and perhaps put under a conservatorship, all for their own good, because they are the carrier of a mental illness, or the victim of a chemical imbalance, whatever the fashion of the moment is. They're weirdos, they're wingnuts, and they're acting improperly. I'm not the one to say that I haven't had my share of people that I call wingnuts and weirdos, but I must say that I've never had anyone 5150'd. That's the one. I think I may have had people arrested in the past who've assaulted me, although it certainly hasn't happened recently. People just don't want... I get assaulted, but the police don't want to arrest them for some reason. The last person who assaulted me was arrested, and he took a plea bargain within 24 hours. I wasn't even consulted. That was the man who attacked the Huff table down at Yuppie Planter in those days when those spaces were open to political tabling, the good old days. So that happens. But in terms of the 5150ing, which is the welfare and institutions code, which says that if a person is adjudged a danger to herself, a danger to others, or gravely disabled, she or he may be locked up for 72 hours for observation, then you can be 5250'd, which means they can lock you up for 14 days, at which time you can be 5350'd. This isn't a joke, and I'm not making this up. This is actually George, what the heck is his last name? He's our psychiatric advocate, paid by the county to actually represent psychiatric inmates in the so-called Reese hearings, the hearings that you have on the grounds of a psychiatric facility if you want not to take their medication. Usually you will lose your Reese hearing because you have to prove that you know the side effects and various other things, and then otherwise they get the thrill of doping you up whether you like it or not, for your own good, of course, and to simply deal with your bipolar disorder. If you hear skepticism in my voice, you do indeed hear skepticism in my voice. Anyway, the law, AB, I guess it was 1421 last year. Before that, it was AB 1400. For some reason, AB 1800 is jumping into my mind, but I believe it was 1400. These were laws that were going to gut the provisions that said in order for a person to be held for 72 hours, they have to be adjudged. Not just a person with a psychiatric history, not just somebody a psychiatrist says is the victim of a mental illness, not just someone who is psychotic, but someone who is a danger to himself, danger to others, or gravely disabled. You want to believe that there is a conspiracy by the CIA to run drugs into this country, if you want to believe that the president is engaged in some kind of aggressive war, intervening in a civil conflict in Afghanistan, if you want to believe these fantasies, that's your privilege. Actually, it's not your privilege. Your privilege is to believe proper things, and the problem, of course, has been that it's not been the content of beliefs or even weird behavior that's been the issue. It has been whether you're a danger to yourself, a danger to others, or gravely disabled. Well, there have been some changes in the law, and they happened when I wasn't looking, because I was trying to keep my eye on this issue last year. This is what I got off the net. This is a fact sheet guide to California's AB 1421, and this law became effective, according to Carla Jacobs, who's the CTAC coordinator, and I'm not quite sure what CTAC is, but perhaps I'll learn as I proceed through this. And also Randall Hagar, NAMI, which I think is the National Association of the Mentally Ill, California Legislative Chair. This law became effective January 1st. It was signed by the governor on October 4th of last year. It modifies the LPS Act, which is the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, which governs involuntary treatment for people with mental illness in California. The legislature finds and declares all the following. Many families of persons with serious mental illness find the Lanterman-Petras Short Act system difficult to access and not supportive of family information regarding history and symptoms. Persons with mental illness are best served in a system of care that supports and acknowledges the role of the family, including parents, children, spouses, significant others, and consumer-identified natural resource system. It is the intent of the legislature that the Lanterman-Petras Short Act system procedures be clarified to ensure that families are a part of the system. Mental illness does not exist in a vacuum of time. The severity of an individual's symptoms wax and wane, sometimes hour by hour or day by day. It is not uncommon for a person with mental illness to present well, with minimally displayed psychiatric symptoms and seemingly rational plans for self-care, when in the presence of an evaluator or law enforcement officer who is considering a 5150, that is, an involuntary hold for treatment and evaluation. Or the person may have had a few days of medication in the hospital prior to a court hearing and been coached as to how to present well prior to a court hearing. Or yet upon release, the person historically has gone off medication, remained unable to care for his or her own psychiatric medical needs, and drifted into homelessness or repeated hospitalizations. See, this is again part of the mythology that the homeless are just all these crazy mental patients that were released way back in the 70s by Governor Reagan, or back in the 60s, actually. I think he was governor in the 60s, or actually it was Governor Brown back in the 50s, if you want to go way back there, without any community mental health facilities taking up the slack. And there is some truth to the fact that there was a shutting down of the big hospitals without community health facilities happening. But we finally got some. There was also badly needed protections, and they aren't really that strong, afforded for those affixed with the label mentally ill in the late 60s, the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, which is here being modified. And let me clarify again, if I can get to the point here, I got to see it, what these modifications are. Modifications are, while nothing in the LPS Act previously precluded a law enforcement officer, hearing officer, or judge for considering the past history of an individual's illness, common interpretation was that they could only consider the person's presentation at that moment in time, i.e., was the person imminently dangerous or gravely disabled? In other words, it had to be, at that time, a danger to himself, others, or gravely disabled. Without reasonable consideration of psychiatric history, a person may be inappropriately and prematurely released, given his or her freedom, without treatment and attaining sufficient stabilization. So this allows folks, this allows the courts, it requires the courts to consider the history, not just a may, but a must. They must consider mental history, medication being taken, and so forth. We have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello? Hello?
Can't hear you there. I think your phone is, I've got an absolutely blank line. So try calling back.
So again, we're talking about this 1421, which was passed and is now law. 1421 requires any person who is authorized to take a person into custody for involuntary treatment consider available relevant information about the historical course of the person's mental disorder if the information has a reasonable bearing on the determination as to whether the person is a danger to others or a danger to self or is gravely disabled as a result. That means that if you have been locked up in a mental hospital in the past, if you have a history of mental illness, they can use that even if, well, they can use that to claim you're now a danger to yourself, a danger to others, or gravely disabled. You're on the radio?
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Free radio.
You are on free radio. I can hear you. Hello?
Breaking.
You're kind of breaking up, though. It sounds like John to me. John, is it you? And again, you're breaking up, so I can't hear you. You're going to have to try again. Sorry about that.
And it sounds like we have someone wants to comment on it.
Yeah, Robert, this is quite interesting because I wonder how the following would play out. There was a case down in Texas where Senator Mike Moncrief discovered that there were bounty hunters that were taking people who wandered into a psychotherapist for marital difficulties or, you know, minor kinds of things, a little talk, psychotherapy, stress at work, this sort of thing. And these bounty hunters were getting kickbacks of like $500 to $1,000 a head if they could rope these people in for involuntary inpatient commitment. So there were hearings actually headed up by Congresswoman Patricia Schroeder on that, and it was quite a scandal that actually led to the collapse of a whole insurance company because they would hold the people involuntarily until the last day of their insurance, and then the people would suddenly be recovered and they would be discharged when their insurance ran out. So the government smelled a scam on that. Now, if a person had actually been held in Texas under one of these bounty hunter arrangements, our local law enforcement could then actually say that that was a psychiatric history, which under this new law could actually be held against that person.
Right, right. Yeah, another frequently asked question, what information should be considered by the law enforcement officer or person designated to effect a 5150 hold in determining historical course? The historical course, meaning is, are you crazy or are you gravely disabled or dangerous to yourself or others enough to be locked up? That if probable cause for detention, shall include but is not limited to evidence presented by persons who have provided or are providing mental health or related support services to the patient and or information presented by one or more members of the family or the person of the person or the person subject to detention. So what it does is it puts the thumb on the scales here and says that I think that they have to pay more attention to mental health workers and family members. And unfortunately, when you're dealing with people get into problems with the mental health system in which it is not an ally but an opponent who is tying them down and drugging them up and locking them up, often find that they're at odds with their family, that's come to believe that it's medication that's going to save the day, or that the mental hospital is going to make everything okay. And, of course, the mental health workers who have a vested interest in believing that this, that what they're doing is making a difference. And I'm not saying it doesn't ever make a difference, or that even, you know, I don't want to judge how many cases there is a positive result and how many there is a negative result. I'm concerned, again, about the civil rights of homeless people, some of whom have mental health labels following them around. You know, and you got a right to be a wingnut, as long as you're not gravely disabled, danger to yourself, or danger to others. I mean, that, to me, is not a bad line to draw. And it seems to me that that line is being significantly blurred here. Is there any penalty for providing false information to the court or detaining officer? The law requires if probable cause for detention is based on a statement other than that of someone authorized to take the person into custody for a 72-hour hold, or a member of the attending staff or a professional person. Note, these people apparently are exempted. The person making the statement shall be liable in a civil action for intentionally giving a false statement. So this is the way of saying, so if your parent lies about it, or if some other person lies, and they're civilly liable. But note, it says a member of the attending staff or a professionals are not civilly liable. They can lie all they want. Come on, guys. What's going on here? Who else must consider the historical course of a person's illness? The shall of the new law requires that hearing officers, judges, and juries who consider whether the person is to be certified for additional periods of involuntary treatment beyond the initial 72 hours must also consider the historical course. That is, statements that are subject to perjury prosecution by members of the family, but are not if you are a mental health official or if you're a psychiatrist.
Or a $6.50 an hour attendant who's disgruntled and is having a bad day.
Wow. The hearing officer, court, or jury shall exclude from consideration evidence that it determines to be irrelevant because of remoteness of time or dissimilarity of circumstances, however, The court retains the discretion in what it defines as evidentiary and having a direct bearing on the current case. The historical course of a person's mental disorder shall be considered when it has a direct bearing on the determination of whether a person is a danger to others, self, gravely disabled as a result of a mental disorder. For the purposes of court hearings, what should be considered in determining historical course? The court should consider 1. Evidence presented by persons who have provided or are providing mental health or related support services to the patient. 2. The patient's medical records as presented to the court, including psychiatric records. These are records that's often very, very difficult, by the way, for a patient to get a hold of. 3. Evidence voluntarily presented by family members. And 4. The patient. The patient may also designate an additional person to provide information. Well, isn't that big of them? How nice. Who is obligated to present evidence provided by the family to the court? Facilities providing treatment shall make every reasonable effort to make information provided by the family's patient available to the court. So this is a way of letting the family get their two cents in, which, as I said, is sometimes not so good for a person who's trying to get out of these psychiatric toils, and sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes it's really the situation with psychiatric disorders or psychiatric splits between members of the family. It's a real ball of wax, and it's sometimes, as I said, you get families who can be the worst enemies to other members of the family, and the best thing that people can do who have psychiatric problems is get the hell away from their family and deal with new environments. That's always been my advice to people. Must anyone consider the medication history of the person as part of the historical course? The law requires that the agency or facility providing the treatment acquire the patient's medication history if possible. So, if you don't like taking your meds, then that presumably is a strike against you, or can be, if it's worked into an argument that you're a danger to yourself, danger to others, or gravely disabled. And there are also other provisions that prohibits any health care plan, service plan, private or public insurer, including Medi-Cal or disability insurer, from utilizing voluntary or involuntary status for the purpose of determining eligibility for claim reimbursement. So it means that them psychiatrists are going to get paid no matter what, and it also means that you cannot be discriminated against because of these involuntary or voluntary findings.
Robert, excuse me, it's my understanding that medical records are confidential. Are they trying to wipe out confidentiality of medical records?
Well, it's not confidential. It's confidential in a certain sense. It's limited to the doctors and the hospitals that you get wrapped up in. However, if you are brought before a court, what's being said here is the records have never been confidential with respect to the courts, I don't think.
I wonder how that would play out if a patient just gave the judge a big fat no and just denied signing the consent form. Because I know every time I go to
psychiatric patients don't have to sign consent forms.
I have my knee worked on. I always had to sign off just to get a copy of my knee X-ray.
We're talking about involuntary hospitalization. That's what this is about. 72-hour holds, 14-day holds. We're not talking about places where you give consent. That's sort of a different deal. This is actually a positive spin on AB 1421, the new law that's now in effect around the Landerman-Petras Short Act. And I called the Sacramento mental health advocates concerned about the rights of mental health advocates. They hadn't heard about this legislation, which made me really nervous, and they never called me back. So, you know, it could all be a major hoax from the California Treatment Advocacy Coalition, but I don't think so. It's pretty specific. So I'm going to try to do some more research on this and get back to you folks out there who are wondering what your rights are when the psychiatrist or the cop comes to call and drag you away from the downtown, because your protesting shows you're just a little bit too manic. I'm sorry, it's time for a 72-hour hold for you. I don't wish to claim that the downtown mental health worker, whoever she or he is at the moment, I don't really know who that is, has been abusing her or his prerogatives. I don't have a lot of information on that. In fact, I'd like to get some information on how they're being treated. No, it's not Eric Seeley. Eric Seeley is the homeless services officer who is apparently, according to some people's testimony, abusing his power by slashing people's tents and taking their stuff. But that, again, I have not been present when this has been done. I've just heard these reports secondhand from two people in the last 2 weeks. Here's a couple of quick stories on the internet. Here's one from M. Warren, Michigan. City officials are mulling a ban on camping February 18th, which some say is targeted at chasing homeless people from the area. The law is needed, they say, because some homeless people are a nuisance. There are growing complaints against vagrants and crimes linked by police to the homeless. In some cases, vagrants have tapped water and electrical service, officials said. There are actually people setting up camp to live in the city, City Attorney George Constance told the Macomb Daily of Mount Clemens for a story Monday. The anti-camping law, which doesn't include the words homeless or vagrants, is simply in response to those complaints, officials said. They said they need a way to keep vagrants from setting up homes in the community. But those opposed to the proposed law have said it isn't a good solution and unfairly targets the homeless. So-called tent cities have popped up in Macomb County as far north as Shelby Township. Experts said more than 300 people are in homeless shelters in the county on any given day. There probably are twice as many in the streets. It's a band-aid, said Jametta Lewis, executive director of the Macomb County Rotating Emergency Shelter Team. It isn't a solution. They're just moving homeless people along, just spreading the rash until another community comes up with an ordinance. And that's from the Detroit Free Press. I'm going to play, before this time is up, I believe we're going to play a bit of Matisse Selman. I promised him I would, and I found the time is slipping away. I apologize, Matisse. I'm not able to get all this out. Let's see if we are at this point on the tape where, again, we're getting back to the yuppie planter controversy, the issue of the new fence that's gone up around Alibaba's Cafe and Sushi Now, the area between those two down at Pacific and Lincoln Streets.
See what caused him to undertake this severe step.
I don't know.
I'll ask. Thank you. Hey, Matisse, you want to comment on the current scene?
Come on, you twist it all
around. I'll play everything you say. I will not omit a word.
You twist everything around, Robert.
Because there's a ticket man here who got a ticket. He says you complained about his behavior. And
I didn't complain about his behavior.
Oh, he's mistaken. You didn't.
No.
Okay, I'll put that.
I'm going to interrupt this by saying, when I went back to the man, he told me that it was his father, Matisse's father, who complained about his behavior. And Matisse, I've got to tell you that it's appropriate for you to say if a relative who's very close to you is complaining, who's spending a lot of time and may have a financial involvement in your business, may not, I don't know, I think you're being a little bit, deceptive isn't quite the word, but you're not giving the whole story here. Let's hear some more. I'm going to, as I said, give you the opportunity to have your say.
Anything else you want to add? How's the business been?
It's been okay. I've had a lot of support, actually, for this, because people are tired of having their rights walked. I hope you do play that.
I will play everything you say, and I'll play it this evening. So anything you want to get out there, if you want to ask people to come down and patronize Sushi Now, feel free to do that.
What about, I'd like to hear your experiences. I know you've had some bad experiences eating, because you used to be a regular customer here. You've had some bad experiences eating here.
I used to have very good experiences with the management. I felt the management was first of all, it seemed especially sympathetic to the surrounding community, and I appreciated the way, and even in the course of this protest, though we've had our differences, you have at different times, you've given sushi to a musician who was playing here, as I remember.
I don't want to do those. I do those things not to be broadcast on the radio, but out of the kind. I mean,
I'm not suggesting you did, but I'm saying that was my observation. And I've just talked to a couple that they're friends with Ali, but it's putting a severe strain on the friendship, this fencing that's happened. But your question of me was, how was I treated down here?
Have you had any bad experiences with some of the hanger-outers?
I've had, my problems have included things like smoking, people smoking near the tables, which I don't like when that happens. It's included things like.
And so what would be the answer? Just in a nutshell, would be the answer to smoking, because you really can't enjoy sushi to its fullest, especially Sushi Now, without. With cigarette smoke in the air.
Right.
You know, cigarette smoke definitely takes away from any kind of food. I mean, even, you know, I used to be a smoker. I used to smoke cigarettes. And, you know, you can't eat and smoke cigarettes at the same time, or even smell it.
Well, I don't like cigarettes generally, but my answer would be there would be two things. One would be that you could either ask a city council to pass an ordinance about no smoking within 50 feet of a sidewalk restaurant or kiosk, I suppose, which might or might not pass, I don't know, but which wouldn't otherwise limit the rights of people, let's say, to use the public spaces, which I think is what the major controversy is about.
It's people abusing their right to use the space, which caused this incident to happen.
Well, this is a construction that's actually happened. It's more than an incident. It is a you know, you've demarked the space and privatized it. Sorry?
I'm going to eat.
He's going to eat. Well, we'll talk to you later. The man is having a meal. Your name again is?
My preferred name is Free Spirit. Actually, Free Love. It's my preferred spiritual name. I don't go by my given name any longer. That's been like 2.5 years.
And it wasn't Matisse who gave a ticket. It was, in fact, his father.
It was his father, the owner of Sushi Now, that complained about the obscene language.
So his father owns Sushi Now?
A separate ticket. Yes, he does.
Really?
A total setup, isn't it? How convenient.
How do you know he owns Sushi Now?
I was told.
Because I always thought it was Matisse who owns it, but I'm not sure. I've got no indication either.
Well, that's what I was told. Maybe the story's a little cross, but someone concerning Sushi Now and the management gave me the ticket as far as issued the complaint.
Which is a misdemeanor, which is sort of an uncomfortable ticket.
And not only that, the way the officer, Baker, approached me, he just straightforwardly asked me, without any probable cause, for my ID. And it's against our personal rights to just ask for your ID instead of your name. He just kept asking for ID. And after each time that he asked me, about 4 or 5, I asked him within each time, I said, why do you want my ID? And he wouldn't answer. And I asked him 4 times, and he would not answer until I had to give him my ID, because he was intimidating.
The only time you have to give me your ID is when he says you're under arrest. That's the only time that you're required.
Okay.
And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides for February 21st. We will be back on Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning with another edition. And if you want to be involved in Huff projects, and we want your help, we're trying to go through questionnaires and going to be probably tabling tomorrow, probably 12:30 or 1 o'clock down there at Yuppie Planter. And we're going to be out there. I'm going to be doing a speech along with Becky Johnson and others at 11:30 on Saturday down at the town clock on the march on to free all political prisoners. That is going to be happening downtown. Plus, of course, there's the upcoming Anarchist Coffee House at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. Hey, there are all kinds of things happening. So give a call to the Huff line for the Huff perspective at 423-HUFF. And I think that's pretty much it. We're going to be rolling into a little David Rovics to end off my part of the evening. And it's David Rovics, I think you might not have heard. There's a lot of David Rovics been bouncing around free radio that everybody's heard. I'm getting quite a little bit sick of, but this is some David Rovics I haven't heard. We may, however, have a quick word from Palo Alto. Hi there. You want to say something from Palo Alto, sir, on the air?
Robert, this is Danny. I'm listening to your radio program. You're a very talented radio personality, I think, by the way. And there's a little bit of a delay between the time you actually speak and the time it actually comes to me on the Internet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn this off so I'm not confused.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm talking to you directly. Can you hear me?
You are, but we only have about like a minute because we our next our DJ
is... I tuned in because I wanted to put in a plug for the internet news groups. As you know, I'm the founder of a homeless internet news group called All Society Homeless, which is on the Usenet.
Mm-hmm.
The Usenet is a big part of the internet, but not too many people are capable of getting to the Usenet because
mm-hmm.
most people are not very savvy with their web browsers and everything, but a lot of people do get into the news groups, and All Society Homeless is the only homeless-related news group on the internet. And for Santa Cruz, we cross-post to a couple of Santa Cruz-related news groups in addition to All Society Homeless. So
mm-hmm.
the message goes to more than one news group. And one important news
round it up in 15 seconds, Danny.
Yeah. It's called Santa Cruz General. It's S-Cruz, S-C-R-U-Z dot General. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Next time you're on the radio, I'll try to call in and maybe we can talk a little more about this.
Sounds good.
And I think people are indebted to you for a very, very good free speech radio program that you've been conducting.
Hey, thank you.
Very, very impressive what you've been doing.
Appreciate that. Bye-bye.